These are real people. They do have struggles.
And it starts to get on my nerves. I just shut down.
So many people suffer from mental illness.
To get the word out that men have got to start talking.
A lot of people don't understand the depth of the situation, so they can't appreciate,
It's difficult dealing with our minds, and the suicidal thoughts were back.
People knew that there was something not right, but they just never really said anything or probably felt like it wasn't their place to say anything.
You're not depressed, it's all in your head. That's probably the statement I've had people say the most.
I mean, this shit is real, and it's hard, it's exhausting.
Sometimes you need somebody to just give you permission.
And I think people realize how helpful that one conversation can be just to figure out why you are feeling the way you are.
Not only did this help me to write it, it potentially might have helped some other people as well. So it sort of started from there.
People just want to know that they're safe to talk and share these things.
So many people think they're alone. And then you hear other people talk about it and they think, oh, that's so brave, or I could relate to that. And then they want to talk about it.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Open Journal podcast. I hope you're well. Hope things are good for you right now. I'm delighted to say we have a returning guest in this episode. Emily's back with us today. We're going to be talking about neurodivergence and mental health and sharing some of our own lived experiences. Emily shares a lot of insights linked to some previous conversations we've had before around lived experience, but also her expertise and experience in the workplace as well. We're having this conversation as it kind of follows on from Neurodivergent Celebration Week and having the conversations that kind of float around our circles around mental health and how that can overlap or be impacted by our neurodivergence. Neurodivergent Celebration Week is the 18th of March to the 24th of March. So if you want to go back and have a look at some of the campaigns, resources, conversations that have been shared as part of that, do that. Thank you so much for continuing to listen to the podcast, support, and just be involved in so many different ways. As always, if you'd like to be a guest in the future, please have a look at the website for more information, which is openjournalbc.com. And if you enjoy this episode, please do leave a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. Thank you so much for continuing to support, and thank you to Emily for coming back once again to have an awesome conversation. I hope you enjoy this episode. Here is our conversation. Emily, it's lovely to be sat down and have the chance to chat with you today. We're talking just at the end of Neurodiversity Celebration Week. How are you? How's your week been?
It's been a refreshing, hopefully refreshing start to the week. It was very overwhelming last week, quite an emotional roller coaster. But hopefully this week, it's, spring is here, some sunshine has finally arrived. So hopefully this week, and it's a nice short week at work with Easter coming up. So I'm looking forward to my 3-day week and being on annual leave for a couple of weeks after.
Oh, amazing. I'm sharing in your excitement because I worked over the weekend and I'm like, I feel so drained for a Monday. I feel so drained. And I'm like, I've just got to get to Thursday evening.
Yeah, literally. But no, on Thursday, I've got 2 weeks off. So I'm looking forward to it. And it's going to be a recharge for good reasons this time, not time off for other reasons. So yeah, it's annual leave reasons and not life reasons.
That's really good. That's nice. Like you say, it feels really... I don't know, stereotypical start to summer. Like, we've had a couple of quite nice, almost warm, sunny days scattered in with a couple of wet days. So I guess it's now spring.
Hopefully, yeah. I had a full-on hailstorm on Saturday and a thunderstorm, so that was interesting. But the sun's shining today, so fingers crossed that the spring is on the way. And yeah, all the flowers are out, so lots to be grateful for.
Yeah, I think I've had the last couple of episodes, we've had bits of the conversation relating to like spring and well-being and kind of having that opportunity to get outside or do different activities to support our well-being. Is there something you're looking forward to kind of this spring as we move forward through the year that you're going to introduce into your kind of well-being activities or something you're looking forward to?
Yeah, I think it's just being more present and more mindful, more grounded. And I've taken up yoga now, so in a really positive way for pain management. So I'm under sort of a pain service, and they've introduced like weekly yoga classes, and they're just getting all the technology set up so that we can do daily sort of yoga from home as well in between the weekly class. I think, you know, I've got a yoga mat, I've got the garden. So, you know, I'm going to go and embarrass myself in front of all the neighbours and just be yogured, you know. And I think hopefully, you know, that'll just allow me to be with all the daffodils. The bluebells are going to be coming out soon. I've got like a big bluebell wood in my area where I live. And they come out in sort of end of March, beginning of April. And, you know, it's just an entire forest of bluebells and you can just go exploring. There's like swings on trees and there's the sea right by it and the cliffs. And it's just, yeah, like my safe haven that I won't run away from.
Oh, that sounds really nice. I think just those different outside spaces, I think. Yeah. It's not that you can't use them in the winter. It just feels so much less appealing, doesn't it, I think, very often. And if you're someone that does have certain struggles or difficulties with your well-being or your mental health, and I think again just makes it harder to access those spaces. And if that is something that helps keep you well, it just becomes a harder task at a time when we could really do a bit of an assist. So I'm looking forward to some of those things just being a bit easier to do or incorporate into our kind of maybe not daily but sort of fairly regular routines.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's giving us that time to do that because I think, you know, life can be so busy and a bit like work. And I'm like, I've had to learn sort of in a bit of a role. I've been a bit of a roller coaster of a journey sort of the last few weeks. And I've just had to take time out and I've just had to go, do you know what? If I don't work today, if I don't put on the laptop and I just go and sit in the garden, sit with some birds, do some drawing, that is absolutely fine. And that is what I need. Otherwise, I'm just no use to anybody or myself.
Having that time and those sort of different activities, but also sometimes solo activities, I think is something that sort of feeds into kind of part of our conversation around sort of neurodiversity and how that affects or can affect our mental well-being. I'm just wondering if you have certain insights to what your thoughts are around kind of neurodiversity and how it links into mental health, either in a general sense or in your own experience.
Yeah, I think those that are neurodiverse, we're also unique and individual and different. You know, I see it in my job every single day. I see it in the work that I do and the events and the training and, you know, delivering all sorts of things. And actually for me, it's so important that we don't self-compare to each other, you know, because one neurotypical person might absolutely love being full on busy, you know, not stopping. And then you get the groups like me where we're like, actually, we need it to be in the middle. We need the balance of being busy, but actually the balance to stop and unwind and just, you know, actually recharge to be a functioning human. And it's having to, I think, have that self-awareness. And I think for me, it's about knowing, you know, I'm so visual, I have to now be visual with my overwhelm because sometimes I don't even recognize it. And if I can be visual with it, if I can draw what overwhelm looks like, what it might feel like, the warning signs, all the indicators to people, you know, give them a copy of it, they can sometimes recognize it when I might not recognize it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. I think because that thing, isn't there, about, I think particularly when it's someone that sort of knows you, even as a like an acquaintance, it doesn't necessarily have to be someone that's close to you, but sort of recognizes that sort of shift, that change. And they might not be able to tell exactly what it is or put their finger on it, so to speak, but to go, I know there's something about you is a little bit different. How are you feeling? Is something going on? Because, yeah, like you say, it can be that we have spent too much time doing the thing that we find particularly difficult, or elements of kind of masking some of those things that, depending on kind of where you fit within that neurodiverse kind of experience, might be a thing that you spend quite a lot of time masking your experience in some of your behaviors, and that can become like so tiring. So it might just be that someone notices that you seem a bit tired or a bit worn out, but they don't know why. And I think that's where, like you say, that some of those conversations can come in, and sometimes can be more noticed by other people than you, because you might think, oh, I'm okay, I'm feeling a bit tired, but I'm okay, I'm getting on.
actually it's not that noticeable that I'm really struggling or whatever's going on. And someone else that's not you, just sometimes, yeah, there can be that thing, can't there, where that they just notice that change or that shift first.
Yeah, definitely. And I think if people don't know you, it's really difficult. But when people know you, it's like sometimes it's a bit, what's the word? Like, they can be right on your back. It's because they care, you know, and obviously they're interested, but sometimes you just need them to, you know, politely back off a little bit, you know. But they just have your interests at heart. And I think that's so important, because sometimes I don't recognize it when burnout is happening, or, you know, because a lot of my other mental health struggles link into my neurodiversity. So I think actually they sometimes see things that I might not always see until kind of I've hit the overwhelm fullness and everything's pouring out, and that can be really challenging. So I think, you know, if that understanding from others and that their perspective, you know, I don't just jump straight to conclusions now when they suddenly jump in going, I've noticed this about you or noticed that about you. In the past, I would just be like, I'm fine, you know, tell them to go away politely. But now I'm like, actually, I just need to stop and listen and take it on board. And then that helps me to sort of just sit and go, actually, I am at this place and I need to possibly do this to help me right now.
Yeah, and it's so tricky, isn't it? Because like you said, that sometimes other people notice it first, but also the way they respond to it isn't always the most helpful for us. And sort of everyone has those different experiences and insights as well, don't they? And I think both myself and my wife are different types of neurodiverse. So like the things that we struggle with are different. And we're getting better at recognizing when each other is getting to a point where something is affecting us, and we know more about how to respond best for the other person. But that's like lots of conversation and trust that's built up to be able to have that rapport. And like you say, when someone's maybe I always find it like an acquaintance, I find sometimes reacts better than like a friend. Because there's that element of distance. There's almost sometimes more of a politeness around it. Like, oh, I've noticed something. Like, how are you? Whereas someone that's a bit closer maybe is slightly more abrupt or assumes a little bit more about you because of the closer relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, you know, it's just trying to, I don't know the word I'm looking for today, but it's almost trying to, you know, ask people to sort of, I guess it's those boundaries, you know, with people and who you share with and what you share and how they interact with you. Because sometimes people just, you know, try and help, but they help too far. But sometimes they, because they care. And I don't know if I'm making any sense, but I know what I'm trying to say.
I feel like it's one of those, it makes sense to me because I understand what you're saying, but I almost feel like there's a mini secret conversation happening where you sort of everyone's uncoding it as they listen, if that makes like it's the if you know you know kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think as well, because there's just so much within my mental health and neurodiversity, within like my eating disorder and my self-harm, the depression and my trauma and anxiety, you know, there's so many different sort of symptoms and awareness to be aware of, and different behaviors and feelings and emotions. And when people start to notice that changing, you know, I might not always be noticeable of it, but they go, actually, we've noticed this about you, we've noticed that about you. And that kind of has to make me really stop and think, going, like, I just have to sit with myself and grab myself and go, actually, where am I right now? What is happening? And try visually express that in writing or drawing if I can't verbally find the words. And I think that's really important. And it's having to make sure I find the right person to do that with. And, you know, it's just having to be that honest, true self, which can be really hard sometimes.
For sure. And are there things that kind of, you talked about having that moment to pause or reflect yourself, are there sort of activities or tools that you find that are particularly helpful when you need that pause or reset or grounding?
I think I have something called a trigger awareness toolbox. So I've got lots of different triggers within my mental health. So like there's lots of triggers for my eating disorder. You know, I'm not going to go into too many details to trigger anyone, but there's lots of triggers for my depression and my anxiety and all of these things. And like actually, if I notice a change of my behavior and my relationship around my food, my eating, my sleeping, just even my mood and like how I relate to other people, it can be, if something has changed in that way around that, that's normally an indicator that something's not quite right. Mm-hmm. And I have to be brave to explore it, because in the last couple of weeks, you know, I call it the storm of life. You know, I've used other language, which probably isn't appropriate for the podcast, but, you know, I call it the storm of life, and everything just happens all at once. And then people just noticed all of this and they were like, just stop and take a breath. Where are you? Just pause where you are and just be still for a minute and see where you are and what's happening. And then that kind of helps direct me back on the direction I need to be.
Mm. I think those are the times when I'm always conscious that often the things I find quite helpful to ground are the things that are kind of used as throwaway examples, like the walking and running, like just going outside and standing outside for a little while, are things that actually help me. But I think they're not things that help everyone. Yeah. And I always feel like the need to be quite careful or conscious when talking about those, because they often are the things that are used as like throwaway examples when someone's really struggling, to say, oh, go and do these things and that'll sort you out. And it's like, well, for many people that is not the case, and for many people they do need that intervention of, you know, support, whether that's professional services or just talking to somebody. But at the same time, I've talked to quite a few people now that have said similar things, where like the elements of walking and running and being outside, like the fresh air, the different kinds of like contact or mindfulness that you can do as part of those activities, really play an impact in both how they manage their mental ill health, sometimes elements of kind of neurodiversity, and also just general day-to-day well-being, sort of regardless of any sort of diagnosed illness or symptoms. So I think there is a real importance to recognize, you know, those things that are used as sometimes as throwaway examples are still helpful for some people. You know, having a bath, doing some coloring, like they're all really helpful for the right person at the right time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, sometimes if people don't know you, like crisis teams, they might just be, oh, you know, go and have a cup of tea, go for a walk. And it would be like, sometimes you want to F and blind back at them going, do you realize I'm in this situation right now? This is happening. You know, you really, you know.
Yeah, are you joking? Like a walk is not going to help this crisis.
It's just, you know, whereas then you've got the wonderful helplines like the Samaritans. You just sit and talk to them and go, this is how I feel. And they're like, what's that feeling look like? How is that feeling for you? Like, how is it affecting you? And like, is there ways you can think about to me? And it's just like, actually, that gets you to stop and think. And I'm like, yeah, that's happening. And just, I think we all, you know, because obviously I've done my level 2 counselling and I'm doing my level 3 sort of later in the year. And actually, it's like sometimes just sitting and listening to somebody and being with empathy and walking alongside them is the best thing that you can do, because you're understanding who they are, where they're at, what's happening, and trying to just sort of go into their world and imagine it's them and see how they can help you, if that makes sense. I don't know.
I think there's an importance in that as well, of that obviously you're speaking from the point of a large element of training and education is going into kind of the career that you're moving forward with, but recognizing as well like that the key thing you talked about, listening, just sitting and listening to someone, is a thing I would say anyone can do. It's a skilled person that does it well, and I think that requires some recognition that you're not going to be a master listener by your first conversation.
Yeah.
But taking that time to ask an open question and just giving someone space to answer it honestly, and just take time and keep doing that, and you will get better at asking the questions and giving the space for the answers. And gradually you'll find people will answer. I don't want to say more honestly, because that feels like I'm saying they're being dishonest the rest of the time, but they will answer more openly. if you're the right person in the right space. But yeah, I always find listening a really interesting one, because it is something I personally think we should be encouraging everyone to do, but with the recognition that it is a skill and something that takes time to develop. And some people are, you know, going to be, I don't know, would you say some people are more natural listeners than others, and some people it takes time to adjust to, like, yeah, not jumping into the conversation and answering your own question?
Absolutely. I think as well, going back to neurodiversity, some people really struggle with that. If you're neurodiverse, if you're autistic, it can be really hard to pick up on those social cues of mm-hmm. where to maybe respond back to somebody or understand and process, because, you know, I see it in my job all the time, and I see it, you know, when I share my lived experience and deliver training, that people with autism need so much more time to process information. And it can be like a little washing machine in their head going, like, what am I processing? Like, what's that person just said to me? And they're throwing all this information at me. And I'm like, where the hell do I start? You know, and it can be really difficult to unpick those key points and then kind of get churned in the middle of that washing machine for a little while. But then actually, you know, what I've learned in my counselling training so far, that actually if you just say to somebody, the person you're working with, I've got autism, I might just take slightly different ways of interpreting and processing, and just checking in with them that that's okay. And then, you know, working alongside that. And actually, once you give that education and that training, it can build that awareness and understanding, because, you know, that's what my job is. You know, I deliver training to mental health and eating disorder teams and medical staff and surgeons and hospital staff. And already that's changing the way they interact with people but that are neurodiverse or autistic, because they know that they're not going to maybe take things in of somebody that hasn't got those experiences.
Totally. And I think that side of recognizing the different way those processes can happen as well. And I feel like I saw something recently where someone was talking about their experience being interviewed for a job. Mm-hmm. And it was an online, like probably through Zoom or somewhere, interview. And they were talking about, kind of, as someone that's autistic, it can sometimes be quite difficult to pick up on, like, what's the actual question you ask. Like, I'm awful for this, where I'll waffle for a minute and then in there somewhere was a question. Yeah. And they said, but in their interview on Zoom, the person asked the question, and then, like, the second person, or I think that, like, the second person on the panel then typed the question into the chat and then posts the question in the chat. So you've got both the video conversation that's happening, but also then the clear sort of prompt or reminder to what the question or the structure is. And I was like, oh, that's a really useful thing. And like a lot of things, thinking, well, how do I start doing stuff like that? How do I incorporate that? And often they're not really that difficult things to do. You just need that initial prompt to go, how can I make this more accessible, or how can I make this more like an enjoyable experience for someone, rather than a lot of the time realizing I'm drifting again with a different point in my same bit of, I remember years ago doing like some walking tours, and yeah, there's like, this is the route we take, but if anyone's got some accessibility needs, here's a different route. So if you're in a wheelchair or using walking aids, you use like route B. And I was like, why are we not just all going on route B then? I don't understand why are you doing two, just do one route and make the one route you do an accessible route. And it seems like it's that sort of disconnect sometimes makes it more confusing for also people that don't have that same either disability or neurodivergence, because there seems to be this constant, here's the way, and then there's a load of other alternatives.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, it's like even those environments, because, you know, a lot of my job now, I deliver training in neurodivergence and eating disorder treatment and training in mental health and disability. And in that training, I talk about the environment, I talk about, you know, because a lot of my experiences in mental health and eating disorder treatment in inpatient facilities, they've been really bright, really loud, really noisy, really clinical, really awful places. And that's sometimes all the option you've got. It's like, oh, you must comply with this, you must obey this, you're stuck here, you've got to work with it. Otherwise, you're not complying with your treatment and you're untreatable. And actually, you know, when I went to the old inpatient unit that I was in and actually delivered, you know, environment training with them and awareness of improving those environments for people with mental health and eating disorders and some suggestions and things to consider. And within a year already, so many improvements have been made, like the environment's been adapted, they've built sensory environments. And, you know, we even work now that every individual, you know, and I still have it in my support, but we treat every individual as a unique individual canvas to understand what is important to them when you get to know them. What do they need? You know, we think about the grounding technique. What do you need to see, hear, touch, smell and taste in this environment? What do you need to feel safe? What do you need to feel connected? And that is the key things that we ask in sort of neurodivergence and mental health and eating disorders and even medical treatment, because actually once you have those key things, it doesn't have to be much. You know, I'm working with my eating disorder service and, you know, I was having some support and actually someone else came into the service and they just needed the lights to be dim. So actually they put in dimming lights, you know, they've managed to sort all the lighting out so that we can dim the lights now, you know, just a simple change like that. And that was just so important. And actually, you know, they've kind of like gone to the quieter part of the building and all of these different things. And that is just so important. And it didn't cost much to do that. You know, it was just a bit of time and that was it adapted. And they would come into that environment. They were like, I need to bring something with me to this environment to feel safe, whether it's something comforting, something safe, a fidget toy, piece of paper, a pen, you know, and we try and accommodate that as much as possible. And that actually, that still helps me as well when I have assessments and treatment and support, because sometimes I just can't sit in a room and talk to somebody. I just have to sit and hold something and draw on a piece of paper and write stuff, hand it to them, and then that'll start a conversation. And then yeah, that kind of brings that connection and that feels a lot safer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Thank you for sharing that. I think it sort of raised a question in my head when you were talking through there, where I wonder whether sort of in some work environments where there are set parameters where we need to improve this and make this more accessible, where we're starting to see those changes, and you talked amazingly about how you've fed into some of those and are seeing some of those changes in different settings. Do you feel, what is my question, sort of I know what it is in my head, I can't think how to word it. Do you feel like we're having similar conversations or as many conversations when they're not about work? So one of the things you talked about was like the lighting, the sound, and things like that, the impact on our senses. And there will be workplace reports and agendas that say it needs to be accessible. So what are you doing to make these changes? But if you are a friend or a family member, do you think, or have you had experience where those very similar conversations are happening about, you know, if you're visiting someone either at home or in a public space, do we talk about those things? Because I feel like we kind of do, but not really. It's usually more afterwards we go, oh, actually that wasn't a great experience and this is why. But it's not really part of our conversation beforehand to go, is that a good place to go because it's going to be quite noisy or quite bright or anything else that sort of feeds into that person's sensory sensitivities.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, you know, sometimes we can't control those environments. Sometimes we have to go in these environments that are just horrific. And, you know, you might change everything you physically can with that environment, but actually the biggest thing is like, actually, what do you need as a person for this environment? If we can't change the environment, what do you need to make this environment better? And, you know, for me, it's been like, I've now got, I don't even know what they're called, but there's these new glasses that I've got. So if I go into a bright environment now, the glasses go darker. So it just automatically, it blocks out sunlight and really bright lights. Don't ask me what the lenses are called, because he used a very long name. I just sat and looked at it, was like, right, okay. And left the optician to do what he needed to do and, you know, sort it all out. And, you know, I saw, oh, blimey, you know, what's this going to be like? And I put it on, and honestly, I looked like Men in Black, you know, when I put it on, and it was all really dark. I was like, oh, but actually, after a few minutes, it just, you know, I can still see people. I can still focus on people, but all that lighting has been blocked out, and like there's just the minimal lighting that you need.
Oh, how interesting.
You know, it's really clever. Like there's some fancy name I'd have to look into that I don't even know what it's called, but it was just recommended by the EM specialist. As part of the sound and the noise, you know, some environments are so echoey when you go into, like, for me, when I've had eating disorder reviews, mental health reviews, like recently, I've had to go, they've had a change around very briefly in the environment because, you know, there's been flooding in parts of the building that, you know, out of everyone's control, it can't be helped. And I was like, I had to go to this part of the hospital where it was just the worst bit that I dread because it's so loud, so noisy, and there's building work going on, you name it, it's happening. And I was like, I cannot go there. But one of the autism workers came with me and she said, what about these ear loops? And I thought, ear loops? Like, thinking I was going to look like Dumbo or something, having to put these big loops in my ear or whatever. And it was this little device that she just gave me to put in my ears. Like, you know, when you have those like ear defenders, like not ear defenders, but like, those little cotton things, I think there's a name for them, that you put in your ears to block out noise. And she just gave me these ear loops and I could still hear everybody, but nothing echoed like it used to. So I could still hear people when I needed to. I could still speak to people and respond, and they could hear me and respond back to me. But all of the other like loud noise was completely blocked out. And, you know, it was just like earbuds. It was just so important because I could still focus on a conversation, but didn't have all this other noise to worry about. I could still hear the minimal noise that I needed to hear, you know, like if somebody was coming, or, you know, like if when the doorbell goes or whatever it is, and that's okay. I don't have all the other background noise, like, you know, really loud cars in the background or machines or, you know, phones ringing. So that's really important.
It's really useful as well, I think, to have those conversations to make people aware of the different things that are available, whether you fit into different types of neurodiversity windows or brackets or whatever. I think if you are affected by different types of sensitivity, to know about what tools or resources or things are out there as well, because I've heard a few different people talk about the loop earbuds, I guess, is the closest thing to describing what they are. And I know some people that they've worked amazingly for, and some people they haven't quite worked. They're like, it has worked in that it does what it says, but it's just not quite for me. But I'm like, that's still great because you've tried it, you know, and it worked, but not quite. And they'll go on and try something else.
Yeah.
But hearing those conversations makes it more accessible, I think, then to people that haven't tried anything else yet. And it's like, oh, this is the first thing. And like you say, having some apprehension over, oh, like, what are they? Are they going to work? What's it going to look like? But I think increasingly, or hopefully, things like the earbuds will become a thing that you see more often, and just people don't really pay attention to. It's like, oh, they've just got, you know, a headphone in, essentially. And it makes such a massive difference to people's experiences of life, because like you say, yeah, there's the obvious big noises that it's drowning out, but also when you were talking about the echoes, like, that's something I don't think a lot of people would give consideration to, or not equal consideration to how impactful it can be for you in terms of like your lived experience with that.
Definitely as well. And I think, you know, it's so what we also now do, what we've developed in our service is hospital passports and medical appointment passports and communication passports. So it's like a passport when you go on holiday, but actually it's full of things that people need for that environment, like that will have the process of going into the hospital, process going to the assessments meetings, what it might look like. And in there, they've then got a section where is, this is my neurodiversity. This is how I, you know, this is how I cope with loud noises. This is what happens. This is what it looks like. And there's like pictures with them as well. And just simple words. And then it says next to it, please can you consider, and then it's just got bullet points like, please can you consider the lighting, the noise, the room you used with me, please can you consider when you communicate with me, how you speak to me, you know, clarity, you know, writing things down to give to me afterwards, just simple things like that. And you hand this passport over prior to like a week before those meetings, and actually that gives the services time to sit down and go, actually this person needs this. And then they phone them a few days later before their appointment going, we've taken this on board, you know, and they might have a Zoom meeting with that person and go, this is what we've tried to do as best as we can to accommodate that. And then they can work with that ready to go into the service. And that's just so important, because I think, you know, I've had it recently, you know, because I've been briefly back at like my eating disorder service, because there's been, you know, been a bit of a roller coaster the last few months, and they've just, you know, really got back in there early with me. And that early intervention was crucial, but they said it's going to be a different environment because there's building work going on. Obviously we have no control over it, which is one of those things. And you're in this part of the hospital that you have never been in. This is what it's going to look like. This is, and they just gave me like a picture of the hospital and what it looked like and all the rooms, and emailed it to me. I said, can we do anything before you come in? And I just said like lighting, I just said that, writing down the noise. And then they said, right, they actually then FaceTimed me and said, we've done all this, and then tested it with me. And, you know, although I wasn't there in person, they were like doing visual demonstrations. So, but actually when I then went an hour before that appointment, I could then make sure it was okay. And that really helped me to go into that environment.
Yeah, and having that opportunity to sort of talk through the process with someone that's there as well, and know, like you say, so as much as you can do without being there, what is the space, what is my experience going to be like when I'm there, who am I interact with it, who am I interacting with, and having the benefit as well of maybe how is that different to my previous experience, if you, like you say, if you've been there before, and they haven't just made the assumption, oh, Emily's been here, we're just in a different room or in a different part of the building, but that's fine, it's like she knows where we are, so that's fine. There's been that kind of communication and opportunity to share with you and go, okay, we can't do anything, or we can't do much about this, but what do you think, are there things you're concerned about? With all of this information, is there anything else we can do kind of prior to you coming in? Having that open dialogue again, I think, is a really valuable thing. And I think, unfortunately, is maybe, I don't know, from my experience, I would say that's still quite a rare thing that happens.
Absolutely. And I think I've even had it recently where, really positive experience where, you know, I'm not ashamed to say it, but I did have, you know, last few months I have had a bit of a relapse of my eating disorder and the other mental health that links into it, because life went like a roller coaster in polite words, and things happen and things spiral. For me, we know, for me and my experience, that when my physical health gets worse, my mental health gets worse, and then often a life event will tend to follow, and it's like, how do I get through this roller coaster, you know? And then obviously, if I haven't got those skills and tools and resources in place, I can't cope. And then I go back to my old ways of coping to kind of get away from it all. And, you know, I've had to really recognize that that was happening and be really brave and honest and take that mask off that we spoke about, you know, when I spoke about the masks with you. And I had to take that off and just be a me that no one has seen for about a year. And it was awful, but it was a relief. And I had to see this locum eating disorder consultant, because my consultant, not her fault, she was off sick, it can't be helped. And this secretary phoned me, said, this eating disorder consultant has never met you, that's just joined the team 3 months ago, he's aware of you but's never met you, and he's got availability and he is offering to see you, would you like to see him? And I was thinking, like, you know, everything's going through my head, like, oh, he doesn't know me, I have to start the story all over again. And I said, absolutely. And she said, okay, I'll put you. And then he actually phoned me the next day and said, could we jump on a Zoom meeting prior to our appointment face to face? And we sat down together, and, you know, he had a bit, I don't know how you politely put this about people when there's a language barrier as well. You know, his English was, he spoke as much English as he possibly could, but it wasn't his first language. He was really like, he was like breaking the communication down. He was doing clarifying with me and just said, and being really visual and creative, and just saying, he said, I've got 4 days off before I see you. over those 4 days, I'm going to look at everything that you've, so that you don't have to repeat your story, so that I've got an understanding, though I might just have to clarify some stuff just to make sure I've got it right from what I've read and not make assumptions. And then when we meet, we can talk about it, whatever you need to talk about. And just for a consultant to sit and do that in a really busy eating disorder the team already, I just thought, wow, you know, that was so important for me, because no one ever done that. They've just been like, come in, made assumptions, here's some drugs, you know, just eat X, Y, and Z, you know, off you go, you'll be fine. It's like, okay, you know, no one asks you how you feel. They just give you a slip of paper with a drug on, or force feed you, or make you go and get some exercise, like, or, you know, it's like, actually, you need to sit and listen to the person. And even just him saying, you know, normally my appointments are 30 minutes, but he said, I've booked in an hour and a half.
Oh, wow.
I was like, looked at him and I was like, pardon? He's like, I booked in an hour and a half. We don't have to have the hour and a half. But he said, so that you've got time, because, you know, things might come up that are really difficult. And for someone just to sit and do that in a service that's so stretched and busy already, and, you know, referrals are through the roof, it's, that really helped me. Because then I thought, well, actually, I can take that mask off and be honest and be brutal and be brave and just be that the person I need to be. And that was so important, because then that meant that early intervention was straight there, and people just work around me, and work, and it, that collaborative working, and I think of sharing information. So actually, you know, through my job, we've learned how to, I don't do the technology side because I have no idea, but they've got this system now where if you meet people in the service, this is something we've built with lived experience, that actually, if you see somebody new, someone different, somebody on call, or even your regular people, they will then summarize those sessions, put it onto a shared system so that everybody else has got access to it. You sign permission forms and everything. And then you actually get given a code and some system to log into. And you can then actually see that information for yourself as well.
Oh, wow.
And then you can actually just respond to that going, yes, this is right. Or actually, could you also include this? So giving that individual with that neurodiversity and autism that sense of control, that they're feeling heard, understood, and that they aren't just making assumptions. They aren't judging you. They aren't going, oh, it's your autism making you make these decisions. It's your autism way of thinking, or it's your eating disorder's way of thinking. They see you and go, actually, you know, that really helps me, because then I can keep up with everything. Because when there's lots going on, that can be really difficult.
Yeah, I think, oh, it sounds like, obviously, it's not a great experience as to why you're there in the first place. But it sounds like a really positive experience in terms of using that service and the developments that have been made in terms of the accessibility, and just how they're relating to you, and hopefully, I assume, to other people as well, in terms of just talking to you as people and being able to give some consideration for, like you say, whatever your kind of neurodiversity, actually just your lived experience of kind of mental health illness being something that you maybe don't want to like completely relive every time you're going in for a new appointment or meeting a new person, and having the benefit of someone that's like, right, I will have read everything when we meet, so know that I will have read it and understood it. However, I'm a different person, and I might need to ask you a couple of questions just to clarify things immediately. I think I would feel more comfortable to go, oh, okay, so I don't have to tell you everything. You've already got all of that. Yeah. And you're just going to ask me about the couple of things that aren't clear, or because of your experience, aren't, you know, you just want to clarify with me. And again, it opens up that conversation, because it feels a bit more like they're showing interest and a desire to support by asking those clarifying questions, almost more so than just going, yep, cool, I've got everything. So yeah, you need to go and do some runs. Okay, great. You didn't actually read anything.
And it's so important. You know, I had an experience last year actually, when I had a really unplanned medical admission linked partly to my eating disorder, but I've had long COVID, my cerebral palsy, you know, I suddenly got admitted via the out of hours doctor, via A&E, via an ambulance, put on a ward for the night, because it was like 1 a.m. by the time I was in A&E, and they were like, we need to bring you in, because not a lot was going to happen at that point. I was like, absolutely. And I always remember it was like 9 o'clock the next morning, in the morning, and this gentleman walks in, and I'm thinking, I've never seen this bloke, who the hell is he? And he walked in and he said, my name's blah blah blah, I am the consultant on call today, I have been in this area of the country 24 hours. I'm on call and you're my first patient. Oh. And I just looked at him and went, you poor bugger, you know, in my words, because, and I said, right. And he was brilliant. He said, I don't want to make any assumptions. He said, I'm aware of what you've, you know, what you've come in for. They've told me in handover. But he said, I don't want you to have to repeat every single thing again to me. So he said, while you go for all your scans, all your assessments, and while you have all your other tests and checks done, I'm going to go away and read everything that I've got, that I know about you on the system and in your folders, what's already been going on in the past and present and what's happened this time. I was like, okay. And he said, I'll be back with you as quick as I can. 9.5 hours later, he rocks up and goes, I have just read 15 folders of yours in mostly full depth. And most things were covered. And he literally just had to clarify a couple of things. And I just looked at him and thought, how on earth? And this poor guy had been there 16 hours. And he said, I'm not going home till you're sorted. And we have a plan. And he just gave me the time, the space, the patience, and the willingness to share with other people so that I didn't have to share my story again and again. And that was like what I needed, I think, which was so important. And he communicated that to the eating disorder team, mental health team, the out of hours, you know, the discharge teams. And they all sat together and then sat with me and worked out a plan. And that was what's needed all the time, not just once, but all of the time.
It makes a difference as well. And I think when you're talking about like that sort of either a team of support or it's lots of different people in different services, having some sort of coordination of that. And I think to some extent, we've talked a little bit more in our conversations today around the impact of things like different senses and sensitivities and the kind of sometimes overt or covert relation to autism as well.
Yeah.
And I think having that clarity over sort of what is being offered, recommended, what's happening is really useful and needed, but also that balance of these people know me. There's not a lost in conversation or assumptions being made. I'm talking to someone that knows me and I can understand, or they've provided a positive space for us to have a conversation so that I can take in what they're saying and what's being recommended or what's happening as well, is a really, I think, a really positive thing to hear. And hopefully, you know, we're seeing more and more of that happen. I know, kind of anecdotally, I feel like there are more people sharing lived experiences of being autistic in recent years, and also that link into kind of mental health and well-being. And sometimes it involves crisis, not the same but similar to what you've spoken about today, but also just like their struggles with day-to-day life as well, with someone's actually listening or offering or recommending support and not just telling me to like suck it up and get on with it. There is actually support out there that I can and that I should be being offered.
Absolutely. And I think as well, it's what's the word, because with your own lived experience, you know your struggle, you know what it feels like, you know what it looks like to you, and no one else can take that away from you. And you know how, what's helped you in the past, what's not helped you, but that actually you're up for exploring other opportunities. You know, because to me, in the last sort of few months, I'm not ashamed to say it, I did relapse and things did, you know, have spiraled quite a lot, and it's been really, really difficult. And I literally emailed the coordinator the other day and just said, look, I'm struggling with this part of the support I'm being offered. It's really not working out. It's really not helping me. I'm really overwhelmed and I'm exhausted and I don't know, you know, I'm finding that really difficult. And she came back to me within an hour. She said, I have an availability in 2 hours time. Can we have a meeting and work this out? And I was like, oh, okay. And then we came up with a new solution, and already that's changed the way they support me and should actually, let's consider this option because you're creative. And it's meant that I have now art therapy with my talking therapy. And it's also, you know, done in a way where, you know, the appointment's extended to 2 hours instead of an hour. And that gives me time to draw for the hour and then have the hour to explore that as well. So 45, and that's really crucial. And then that really helped, and that visuality that I take away in my treatment because I need that in my recovery, because I'm so visual with my autism that, yes, words are useful. Words help you learn and, you know, have conversations. But actually, I need to put pictures to those words and those meanings and those interpretations to almost create. So I'm part of a project called Storyboard, and actually you're creating your own story on a board. Your journey, it's written, it's drawn, and that takes you on like a journey to walk with yourself and your service and your support. And you know, having that shared with people is really important, because then actually you can tell them where you think you are on that journey, and they'll be like, well, actually, let's explore, what does that feel like to you at the moment, what's it looking like, what's happening. And it's so important to then move away from just focusing on people's physical checks of eating disorders and behaviors, but how are you feeling? What's causing these feelings? What do you think is contributing, and how can we work a way around it to make it easier and less overwhelming?
I think that sounds, yeah, again, just sounds like a very positive experience, and hopefully one more and more people find parity with and have similar experiences when they're interacting with services, their workplace, or with friends and family as well. I'm conscious we're kind of running towards our time, and I always feel like we could probably go on for another hour with a lot of the conversations we have, and it's like just nice to sit down and chat and sort of ponder like what our experiences have been, but also what would we like them to be like, and some of the changes that are happening. I think in the most sense feel like there are positive changes happening, and hopefully we're encouraging more of those to happen. Emily, if there's people listening and they maybe aren't sure sort of where to go to access different types of support, is there anywhere that you would recommend them to go to, or are there people that you think are really useful people for someone to talk to, even if it's kind of like friends and family, that you would recommend?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's quite a lot, isn't it? I think as well, it depends, because every journey is individual and unique. But I think, you know, some of my in my role that I do as well, you know, I provide a lot of signposting and go, actually, have you considered this? Have you considered that maybe? And actually, I think, you know, like for neurodiversity and autism, you know, you've got the National Autistic Society. And honestly, you know, we have training with them, my job, and I take away so much about autism on there and about different ways of communication on there. They've got different ways to engage with individuals. They've got ways that carers, parents, professionals and services can engage with those that are autistic or maybe autistic, assessment processes. And that can be really useful. And so in terms of autism, that's a really positive one, and sort of, you know, for family support and like the work Action for Children and the helpline work, lived experience work and the project work, and like the parent talk service, there's like the helplines, there's like the search finder of support, and that can be really useful because you can type in your postcode and a whole list of things should come up in your area. And the same with BEAT for eating disorders, you know, you've got the help finder and, you know, they've got the helpline, and they can often recommend for eating disorder side of things where to maybe look at options for support, and, you know, and you've got their groups. And I think it's, you know, it's every person's individual, but it's maybe building a support toolbox, going, well, actually, you know, break down that if you're autistic and you've got everything happening all at once, break down everything into small little components and almost go, well, what am I struggling with this component? What's happening? What do I need? And that can then help you to then sort of look at the support you need. Or you might even just need a really close friend to just have a cry with. You might just need a family member to write something down with and talk something through. You might just need to sit on the end of a phone to like Samaritans and go, this is how I'm feeling, and I needed to get this off my chest today. And, you know, that's why they're there 24/7. So it's all of these things, and just be you, because, you know, we always say autism, you're amazing, you're unique, you know, and you're individual. And actually, that differences bring us together and allow us to grow, which I think is really important.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. There's lots of different places for people to look and think, like you say, recognizing everyone's experience will be different and their own. But knowing a couple of places maybe to start off, hopefully, is helpful to people. And if someone that's listening wants to find out or kind of follow you a little bit more, are there places that they can go to find out more about you on social media or websites or things like that, that they can kind of get in contact or keep updated with you?
Yeah, so I've got, for my sins, I still use the world of social media. You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to, like, you know, when we came back out of lockdown nearly 4 years ago, which was quite scary. I was like, oh, I can, you know, reduce my social media content now. And actually, you know, I've used it a lot more, but I've got Twitter, which is at Emily4993 or lowercase. And I've got sort of my main email, which is emily@cwgsy.net. So that, you know, Twitter and my email tend to be my main ones. And I've actually got a link tree as well, which I can send you.
I will include that in the...
Is that the right word, link tree? Yeah, link.
Yeah, yeah. Like your, here's all my things.
Yeah, so I've got that, and I can send you the link to that. And on there, it's got my LinkedIn, my email, my Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, you know, everything on there for my sins. So I think, you know, and just, I think as well, it's, you know, it's not being afraid to reach out, because, you know, I've done podcasts, and when I deliver training, or when I've spoken, you know, I spoke at a national conference recently for the Peace Pathway and Eating Disorders, and, you know, our contact details are available in all these ways, and the amount of emails that came through. But actually, it's, people said, oh, we feel really bad for reaching out, but actually there's no shame in reaching out if you hear someone with experience, because actually you want to learn more. And, you know, sometimes the one with lived experience might need to maybe clarify a couple of things with the relevant people and relevant services before they get back to people, to make sure they've got it right and make sure that they're, you know, understanding the situation correctly. But that brings connection, and that a lot of my training has led to that, because actually I now deliver so much training in autism, mental health and eating disorders, you know, I've had to just slow it down a bit and be like, look, there's only one of me here. I can't do all of you all at once. But breaking it down and actually sharing it with other people, because actually lived experience brings you a network, and you can share with each other, going, actually, this is coming up, does anybody want to help? And you share that workload together, and you learn from each other, and you grow as individuals, and that really empowers and inspires.
For sure. And hopefully that's something people can feel from hearing conversations like this, and hearing people share their lived experience like yourself, and sort of pick up on that opportunity to access support, or to kind of get involved and be part of the conversation, whether that's just to support yourself or to support somebody else, maybe be part of different campaigns or projects or fundraising or volunteering, or kind of in whatever way that is. That often starts with hearing someone share their own story. So thank you so much, Emily, for coming on and sharing your lived experience, some insights and expertise as well, and some personal thoughts around the topic of neurodiversity and mental health, which is kind of what we've talked through today. So thank you so much for coming on once again.
That's okay. And, you know, I always love coming on the podcast with you. You know, I learn so much about myself all the time, you know, from what we've done. And, you know, I'm like, wow, I've been on a journey since we started these podcasts, you know. And actually, sometimes people just learn from a podcast. They might take something away from different podcasts and go, oh, I haven't tried this and tried it. And actually, they grow so much from that idea and that, you know, those things to think about. And sometimes that's what people that sit in the neurodiverse world prefer, because they don't like that face-to-face interaction or the telephone interaction. But actually hearing another voice with that experience can sometimes be the best thing. And I learn from it all the time, and that really helps me.
It's like you say, it's a platforms is the wrong word, different sort of places for those conversations, isn't it? Sometimes it's really nice. I often think of, like, the people listening to this is like the third person. Like, there's three of us sat around a table. There's me, the guest, and the listener. And the listener is that almost like the silent friend that is like really quite interested, but not quite sure whether they want to be part of the conversation yet or not. And it's just, I think, a really nice way for me to imagine us kind of sat around and having that conversation together, and then the opportunity for listeners to go away and maybe have their own conversations. Or, I heard part of this conversation, it was really interesting because this person came on and talked about their experience with this, and that's something I'm interested in, or I feel like it's similar to something I'm experiencing. So yeah, it's definitely different places for those conversations, whether it's blogs, podcasts, in person, in meetings, in conferences, in training. Finding your place and finding your people as well, as you were talking about earlier, and that kind of support system and network you can set up. But
Absolutely. Just be you, literally, yeah. Just who you are, because yes, you've got an autism diagnosis and neurodiversity, a diagnosis, an eating disorder, mental health, but you are still someone underneath that, and you're still an individual, and you are still amazing, and, you know, never be ashamed of your story because it inspires others, is what I always say.
I think that's a lovely point to round off our conversation. Again, thank you, Emily, for coming on and sharing.
You're so welcome, and thank you for all you do, because you're wonderful, and I love your podcast, and yeah, keep up the great work. Thank you so much.
These are real people. They do have struggles.
And it starts to get on my nerves. I just shut down.
So many people suffer from mental illness.
To get the word out that men have got to start talking.
A lot of people don't understand the depth of the situation, so they can't appreciate. Yeah,
it's difficult dealing with our minds, and the suicidal thoughts were back.
People knew that there was something not right, but they just never really said anything, or probably felt like it wasn't their place to say anything.
You're not depressed, it's all in your head. That's probably the statement I've had people say the most.
I mean, this shit is real, and it's hard, it's exhausting.
Sometimes you need somebody to just give you permission.
And I think people realise how helpful that one conversation can be, just to figure out why you are feeling the way you are.
Not only did this help me to write it, it potentially might have helped some other people as well. So it sort of started from there.
People just want to know that they're safe to talk and share these things.
So many people think they're alone. And then you hear other people talk about it and they think, oh, that's so brave, or I could relate to that. And then they want to talk about it.